The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. I'm Judge Greenberg. With me are Judges Allen and Falvey. We're convened today via video conference in the matter of Amanda Wolf versus McDonough. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please make your appearances?
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Blocker for the petitioners.
Go ahead.
Art Stitchman for petitioners.
For the secretary.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deborah Bernal on behalf of the secretary, and I'm joined by Joan Moriarty, Deputy Chief Counsel.
As I understand it, Mr. Blocker and Ms. Bernal will argue. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Does appellant's counsel, Mr. Blocker, do you wish to reserve any time?
I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, Judge Greenberg.
Thanks very much. All right, if counsel are ready, we'll begin with appellant's argument.
Okay. May it please the court, I'm Mark Blocker and I represent the petitioners. Good morning to all of your honors and to Ms. Bernal and Ms. Moriarty. The issue before the court today is the role of class counsel in a case that has been certified by the court. Petitioners filed a motion seeking clarification of our role because we have had, as class counsel, extreme difficulty in getting information about whether VA has been implementing this court's September 19 order. Our primary means of monitoring the enforcement of the judgment in this case is the 45-day reports that the VA has been providing and was ordered by this court to provide. Unfortunately, as this court is aware from our papers and probably from some of the other papers we filed in the other motions, those reports have largely been riddled with errors. And I think VA concedes this point. I don't think there's any dispute that these have been, these have had a rocky beginning. The VA has admitted that these reports have contained inaccuracies and they've continually adjusted and changed the format of the reports. I will say this is not the fault, I don't believe, of Ms. Bernal or Ms. Moriarty. I think it's the wider VA that's having difficulty putting these together. But as a result, class counsel has been trying to verify some of the information contained in these reports by doing random samplings of the veterans who are listed in these reports. And I think you know this story from our papers, but just to revisit this, from the October status report, we contacted 44 class members who the Veterans Administration had listed on their reports as either have had it having some of their claims adjudicated or all of their claims adjudicated. So we reached out to 44. Two of them said they had received decisions. The other 42, however, said they hadn't received any decisions. And that's 90% of the random sample that we conducted. So the report that we received was just plain wrong. We provided this list to the VA in an attempt to see if we could get more information. We were told one of the 42 veterans was misclassified, but the other 41 were just, we got no other explanation. They appear to just be mistakes on the report. To make sure that we could verify the information in the reports, we asked for the decisions that had been rendered for each of these 41 veterans, because obviously if their claims had been adjudicated, there would be decisions. And the VA said no. They said we could not have the 41 decisions. And the only way we could get that information is if we filled out a Form 2122A seeking authorization from the veteran. We don't think that's required. That's why we're here today. But I do want to tell you, we did take VA up on their offer. We did reach out to three of the veterans and got completed Form 2122s. And submitted them to the VA 5 weeks ago. That hasn't netted us any better information. The VA has not provided any of the decisions for any of those three veterans either. So forms or not, we really don't have accurate information about what's going on with the re-adjudications. And judges, this is only the tip of a very large iceberg. We've unearthed a litany of problems with VA's efforts, with the status reports, and with some of the information that's been provided to veterans. Happy to go through that if it will be of assistance to your honor, but needless to say, we don't have any comfort in what's in the status reports, and we don't.
If I may, sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Blocker, but and we're here on a very specific application today, an important one, which will have, I'm sure, ramifications not only for this case, but how the court conducts itself in future concurrent class actions. But I do think it important, if I may, if you'll bear with me before I ask you my first question, and I say the same to my colleagues, just to review for a few minutes what we're dealing with here. Senator Menendez, in December 2009, asked unanimous consent, which was granted in the Senate, to adopt the statute, which is at issue here. He said this would keep, and I'm quoting from the congressional record, this would keep the veteran from being burdened by medical fees with no insurance with which to pay them. Additionally, this bill would also allow the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to retroactively apply this law to emergency treatment received between the effective date of the current law and the date of enactment of the legislation, thereby ensuring assistance to as many veterans as possible. In 2016, this court unanimously made the decision in Staub, in the Staub case, which was promptly appealed by the Secretary to the Federal Circuit. In May or June, excuse me, of 2017, the then Secretary said this to the Senate Veterans Committee. Considering what you have said, he's talking to, and I think Senator Blumenthal, I've decided to voluntarily withdraw the appeal in the Staub case. That was promptly done. That's 2017. 2019, we heard argument, entered an order granting class action status in regard to this and by inclusion, the Staub matter. We've had at least two secretaries, maybe in addition to acting secretaries, we've had three arguments in this case. And here we are in 2021, March of 2021. So Mr. Blocker, what evidence, if any, is there that the secretary has taken what this court has said seriously in terms of making these payments?
Well,
How many have been paid, do you know?
That's a question better directed to Ms. Bernal, but I can tell you
But I'm asking you. I mean, you're here to make this application. We're taking it seriously. And as many facts as I can elicit from you and from the secretary, of course, would be very helpful to the court.
I believe the most recent status report, Judge Greenberg, indicates that roughly 3,000 veterans have received payments from the re-adjudication group. So the class consists of roughly 75,000 veterans, and approximately 3,000 of them have received payment on some or all of their claims. And so do I think the VA is taking its obligation seriously? They're doing something, but they're not moving with the speed that we think is required to remedy what, as you've just articulated, is a very long-term wrong that this court's twice said the VA got wrong. And so, you know, we've said this before, Judge Greenberg, but just doing the math, they've done 3,100 claims so far over the course of 9 months. If you amortize that, if you project that out, how long is it going to take them to complete? It's 17 years when you do the math. Maybe it'll speed up, maybe it'll be 15 years or 13 years, but it's way too long. So, I mean, this is exactly why we're here. We want information so that we can not only verify what they're doing, but also speed it up. And if this were a district court, I understand this is a specialized court with specialized rules, but I don't think any question if we were in a district court, we would get the sort of information that we are seeking the VA to be required to cooperate. And I think, frankly, the roadblocks that the VA has thrown up about not giving us the decision so we can verify information. And keep in mind, we asked for 41 of them just to verify our random sampling. Or, you know, the other thing we've pointed out in our papers, not giving us the address so that, you know, veterans can submit their explanation of benefit forms so VA can process their claims. I don't think the VA is doing enough, Judge Greenberg. I just don't.
Thank you. Yeah. Unless my colleagues want to interject at this point, proceed with your argument. And of course, they're free to do so.
Mr. Blocker, this is Judge Allen. Let's pull ourselves back from the particular dispute we have now. So we have adopted as you know, I think it was effective on Veterans Day, our version of Rule 23. And so particularly we're talking about 23F5.
Yep.
So one of the things, as Judge Greenberg's preamble to his question points out, is this is a matter of first impression, right? The meaning of that rule. And so what we say in terms of resolving your specific issue is at least in part going to be done by articulating a test, if you will, to how do we draw the line between those matters captured by subpart A of that rule from those captured by subpart B of the rule. In other words, there's got to be a principled line to draw to say this is the type of thing that class counsel will be able to do in monitoring versus prosecuting an individual claim, for example. So how would you suggest we articulate that line?
I have two suggestions on that front, Judge Allen. One is, so Rule 20, F5, if you look at F5, it's two subparts. The first subpart says that class counsel is in charge of things that are related to the class proceeding. And in most of the cases that come before you, certainly in this case, the proceedings that are going to be related to the class proceeding is going to be a fuzzy line for you, because it's always going to involve in some semblance something that occurred at the agency, at the regional office, at the BVA. So you can't draw the line the way the VA wants to draw it, which is, you know, if this has anything to do with the, you know, regional office, with the administrative process, you don't get it. That can't be the rule. But I think if you're going to draw a rule, I think it has to have two pieces. One is, I think it has to be interpreted broadly. In other words, what relates to the class proceeding has to be generously interpreted in favor of providing information to class counsel rather than the other way around. So that's one piece of what I think should be part of any decision in this case, that term should be interpreted, those terms in the first subsection should be interpreted broadly. And second, I would say, you know, obviously every case is going to be different, but I think once you get to, you know, a broad interpretation of what is related to the class proceedings, I think you're going to have to rely on the reasonableness of class counsel. In other words, you know, there's probably some point, and I can't identify it for you easily in this case, but there's probably some point at which you could say, you know what, class counsel, you're going too far. That's too much information. That's more than what the VA should be willing to do. And it doesn't relate to the class proceedings. But I would say if the request is reasonable and it relates in some way in a broad sense to the class proceedings, that the class counsel should be able to get the information. And the reason for that is, and I said this at the very beginning, this is coming to you in the context of a certified class. You might have a different rule. You might have a different perspective in a case in which class certification is sought, but it's not yet been granted. We see that all the time in district courts, that class counsel have much more limited powers until a class has been certified. But once a class has been certified, the idea is that class counsel represents not only the individuals who brought the action, but also all of the absent class members who didn't bring the action or didn't know enough to bring the action. And because they don't know enough, you ought to be drawing the line in favor of disclosure to class counsel as long as it's reasonably related to the class proceeding. Now, mapped to this case, Judge Allen, I think that's an easy call, because obviously what Your Honor's ordered was re-adjudications of 75,000 claims. What happens in those re-adjudications is plainly related to the class proceeding. There's been no suggestion by the secretary that we are appearing before a regional office or before the BVA and trying to take over any appeals. We're not doing that. We don't have an interest in doing that. What our interest is in seeing that the re-adjudications get done so that veterans get their money. And if they aren't going to get their money, that they at least get letters that tell them what their appellate rights are so they can make independent decisions. And I know it's a long-winded answer, Judge, but I think that's the right way to draw the line. But the exclusion in the second part of F5, where it says, you know, a class, the matter of, you know, that individual adjudications at the agency will be a matter between the class member and class counsel. Your honors know best what you intended, but I assume that that was in part to tell veterans that this is not your lawyer for all time. This is your lawyer for the class counsel, and not really intended to be used in the way I think VA is trying to use it, which is a limitation, drawing a hard line between what happens in this court and what happens in the agency. Is that an answer to your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay.
This is Judge Falvey. Could I ask a follow-up to that then? How is it then that, I mean, it just seems anomalous that you would be able to get the records of someone who perhaps doesn't know they're a member of the class or doesn't realize it. Maybe you're represented by someone else. So you're seeking the records of a represented person, and they have no way of, and under our system, of opting out of the class, if you will, the way we set it up, they don't have an opt-out right. That seems a little bit anomalous to me.
Well, a couple of answers to that, Judge Falvey. Opt-out classes are not unusual even in other federal courts. So that's not an unusual circumstance. The reason you have non-opt-out classes is because you want all veterans to be treated similarly. But one way in federal, in other district courts, the way that gets handled is you can still send out notice. And in this case, I don't think veterans wouldn't know of our role because letters were sent by the VA to all 75,000 class members to let them know that this proceeding is pending and that something was going to happen, and had information about how to contact class counsel. So I don't think this is the usual case where a veteran just simply has no idea that we are involved in the way that you might in the usual no notice, non opt-out class action. I agree with you, though, that if a veteran has, you know, let's say they're involved in an appeal before the BVA and they already have a lawyer, we're not seeking to interfere with that process. And by asking for information, we are not seeking to interfere with that process. The reason we're asking for that information, to use the parlance of F5, is it's related to the class proceeding. We're not going to come in and tell the counsel to, you know, veteran A in the BVA that we are going to take over, or this is how she or he should litigate their case. But we have the right to make sure that the VA is proceeding on the path that this court's ordered. And that's really all we're asking for. And I bet, Judge Falvey, if you ask some of the people that are represented, and I assume it's a very tiny minority, but I don't know that for sure, but the tiny minority that are represented, those people are happy to have the assistance because this will help grease the skids for their case to be moved along, for their re-adjudication to take place, so hopefully their client can get their money.
But maybe there's some who don't want their private information shared, and they have no ability to object to that if VA just turns it over to you without you executing the form allowing the information to be communicated to you.
I mean, privacy is a legitimate concern, Judge Falvey, but as I said in response to Judge Allen's question, I think the appropriate thing here is to err on the side of disclosure to class counsel because we're not random outsider here.
Right.
We represent the individual, and so as part of this particular class. And keep in mind, what we've asked for, at least so far, is only the decisions. You know, it was a decision rendered in their case. Give us the decision so we can see a decision was rendered in their case. We haven't asked for all the underlying materials yet. We don't necessarily need that in order to determine whether a decision's been made. That's not to say we wouldn't be entitled to it, but at this point, we're only talking about the decisions themselves.
I think.
And Judge Falvey, one other thing I would say is, you know, again, as I said to Judge Allen, class counsel have to act reasonably here. If you have veteran John Smith and Mr. Smith's counsel says, I really don't want you to have this information, We're not going to overrule that. I mean, we have a duty to act reasonably. We have a duty to protect the interests of the class. But if a class member or its counsel calls us up and says, you know, we don't want you to have that, I think we would take that into consideration. We wouldn't override the veteran's choice in that regard. You know, we represent this class. We're trying to do the best we can. But I think for the vast majority of veterans, it isn't a concern about, I care about class counsel seeing my privacy, my you know, the information about my stay in emergency care. The concern is I want the money. I had to pay, so now I want to be compensated.
Okay. You may be going to get to this, so if you are, just feel free to say I'll be getting to that. But if we were inclined to grant your other motion, the motion for a special master, why would that not be a good workaround where the special master can look at these adjudications and confirm that they've been submitted, or the special master can give you some assurance that the adjudications are occurring despite what the 42 veterans indicated to you? Why are they, you seem to lay it out that they go together rather than why isn't the special master do what you give you that monitoring tool versus the let class counsel do this monitoring role? Why do they go together rather than one or the other?
The way I see it, Judge, they should go together, because whether this court agrees to appoint a special master as we've requested, we still have our monitoring role to do. We still have our obligations to the class. We still have an obligation to make sure that the VA is carrying out this court September 19 judgment. So we have that obligation, and I don't think that obligation is relieved simply from having a special master. The idea behind the special master is if there are going to be disputes, we don't always have to come to this court. You can empower somebody to act as a special master and they can hear those disputes. But that special master will also provide a second check to make sure that things are moving along at an appropriate pace, and maybe can get information or can evaluate information from the VA in a way that would substitute for what this court would do. But I don't think I see them as working hand in glove. I think if you set up a system where there's a special master, there's materials that VA's counsel can see, but class counsel cannot see, that's not a recipe for a productive proceeding, because now we're kind of, you know, we're roaming around in the dark. You know, we don't necessarily know what information is out there. You know, we don't have the ability in the same way. We probably have a better ability than the special master to look through it and say, okay, here are the issues. And I think the special master, if one is appointed, it would want that sort of assistance. And obviously the VA would be able to weigh in too, but it ought to be a two-sided coin, not a one-sided coin.
Please add another 10 minutes, and I'm sure that won't be the end. We've taken a lot of your time in questioning, and I want to make sure you feel comfortable, Mr. Blocker, in continuing your argument. So why don't you proceed?
I just have a couple of additional points, Judge, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, but I'm happy to answer any questions that the members of the panel have. If you look at VA's objection to our motion, it really just comes down to a couple of things. Their main objection, as I said, is they want to draw a hard line between things that are occurring in this court and things that are occurring in the agency and treat them as if they are mutually exclusive, but they're not mutually exclusive. That's the very problem with the VA's opposition, is there's absolutely a symmetry. There's a connection between what is going to happen in these re-adjudications and enforcement of the court's order. And so you can't simply draw the hard line that VA wants to draw about, well, if it relates to something in the Veterans Court, fine. But if you're asking about, geez, how are we doing down at the agency level? You can't have that. You can't draw the line in that way. Another argument the VA made in its response concerned this court's privacy protection order, which it issued back in March of 2020 with the agreement of the parties. We would ask your honors to look at the privacy protection order, because if you do, you'll see that it allows class counsel to get, and I'm just going to quote from the order, but other records that are necessary for class counsel to fulfill their obligations to monitor and ensure compliance with this court's September 9, 2019 order. So that was specifically contemplated at the time of the privacy protection order. At the time that we entered, it was to get specific information, class contact information, but it specifically contemplated there could be other things. There's another section that also says that it governs disclosure of any information which is, quote, reasonably necessary for class counsel to satisfy its obligations to ensure compliance with the order. So again, the VA wants to use that privacy protection order and say, well, you know, judge, we can't turn this information over. You know, we'd be violating the privacy rights. But we already have a privacy protection order in place that specifically contemplates this. So while VA says in its opposition that the fact that this information is private and we're not dismissing that concern, but the fact the information is private means we shouldn't get it. No, we have a privacy protection order in place. So, and that would cover this information. The last point the VA makes in its response is they say that we class counsel are, quote, adding to the confusion. Aside from there being no support for that claim, let me make clear. We are not adding to the confusion. We are trying to clarify what is going on here. Our co-counsel at NVLSP have been contacted by more than 4,000 class members asking for information or updates or instructions about what to do in terms of submitting EOBs or things of that nature. The members of our class are relying on us to be able to move this process along. And in order to be able to move this process along, we are going to require some information. And so I think it's unfair to say we are, quote, adding to the confusion. If you look in the VA's brief, most of the things they say that are, quote, adding to the confusion, like the fact that veterans have now received multiple letters, it's mostly, for the most part, correction of things that either VA has been determined to have done wrong, such as, you know, telling veterans that, you know, they can't pay coinsurance or deductibles, or things that the VA's had to correct because they did it wrong the first time. We're not the ones adding to the confusion. VA already created a lot of confusion, but getting the information, expanding the role or clarifying the role of class counsel to make it clear that we have expanded powers beyond what the VA believes will help move away some of that confusion. So, Your Honors, I would just like to save my remaining 10 minutes for rebuttal, but that's all the points that I wanted to make today, unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Judge Allen?
I don't, Judge Greenberg, thank you.
Judge Falvey?
No, I don't, thank you.
All right, just before we move to the Secretary, Mr. Blocker, having spent 45 years on the other side of the bench in litigation as a private practitioner involved many times in class actions on both sides, would it be fair of me and perhaps my colleagues to conclude that what you're asking for is consistent with the action of class counsel in district court or other circuit courts in terms of the specific request you're making here today as to the role of class counsel? And therefore, what you're asking for is also consistent with what Justice Alito indicated in Henderson, that we're acting as an Article III court in supervising the actions of federal administrative agencies.
It's absolute. What we are asking for here, Judge Greenberg, is absolutely consistent with what goes on in district courts, especially once a class has been certified. District courts, tend to be more circumspect about the powers of class counsel pre-certification. So before a class has been certified, sometimes a court will say you're not entitled to the names and addresses of class members. But once a class has been certified, the notion is that if it's qualified class counsel, that you've been appointed to represent the absent members of a defined class. And at that point, you do have expanded rights to get information. And what we are asking for is totally consistent with what occurs in district courts. The only reason you don't see a lot of case law, and we aren't able to put our hands on a lot of case law to sort of drive this point home, Judge Greenberg, is, and you probably know this from your years on the other side, very few class actions get all the way to a judgment in favor of the class. most of them settle if a class is certified, or a lot of times they go to trial and the class loses. But the instances where a class has been certified and then a judgment is entered, there are precious few of those. So there isn't a lot of case law you can look at. You can't, pull out the Federal Reporters and find cases talking about the powers of class counsel in this context. But you certainly do see in the context of a certified class that class counsel has expanded powers to get information about absent class members. And it makes particular sense here once a judgment has been entered, because class counsel's role is to monitor and ensure that that judgment is executed. And that's what we're asking to do. So what we're doing, Judge Greenberg, absolutely consistent with what goes on in other courts outside of the Veterans Court.
Thank you. We'll now turn to the Secretary, Ms. Bernal.
May it please the court. VA cannot disclose veterans' protected health information without either a signed consent from the veterans or a court order that expressly authorizes such disclosure. VA takes veterans' privacy very seriously, and there are several federal privacy laws that control the collection, maintenance, use, and dissemination of private information. In addition, in this case, because the Veterans Health Administration is involved, VHA is a covered entity under the HIPAA, and the HIPAA privacy rules apply to this case. And because of that, VA can only disclose protected health information as expressly authorized by court order, and that's under the HIPAA privacy reg, which is at 45 CFR 164.512, subsection E1 little I. We have one privacy order that the court granted in this case, and it was granted on March 17th, 2020. And it authorized the release of class contact information, which the secretary understood at the time and presently to be information necessary for class counsel to contact the class. And that's what was released, was names, addresses, and email addresses. And the secretary's position is that privacy order is not consistent, is not sufficient to release protected health data under the HIPAA, because it doesn't expressly authorize the release of HIPAA-protected information. And interestingly, because the information is coming from VHA, the Offices of Community Care, even if the letters don't contain any clinical information, and in some cases they do, and in other cases perhaps they don't, but even if the letter's doesn't contain clinical information, because it contains information related to a specific patient, it falls under the HIPAA. So that's a sort of an extra level of protection that is applicable.
Could I jump in for a second? I understand the point you're making, and you can get back to that. With respect to the, and I can't remember the number, I think Mr. Blocker said five, but if it's something different, the five for which they have completed the forms that the VA asked, what reason is it that they are not being given access to that information? What's the next hoop VA is going to require them to jump through?
Your Honor, there is not a hoop, additional hoop with regard. It's three. It's three, Your Honor. Three veterans that have hired Mr. Stichman as their representative, and he will be provided with the letters that for those three particular veterans.
When?
Well, soon.
What does soon mean?
He can be provided, well, for two of them.
Could if we said, give them the letters today, could VA do that?
Your Honor, VA could do that with regard to two of them. The third is an interesting situation that represents a unique situation with regard to the veterans in this class and the fact that these are insurance claims that were submitted by providers. So if you'll allow me to explain,
sure.
the class is defined, the way the court defined the class is all, essentially all claims that had ever been denied for coinsurance and deductibles. And since, you know, there's no temporal limit that goes back to the enactment of the statute. So if a veteran was denied on the basis that they had a patient responsibility, they fall into the class. So one of the veterans that has hired Mr. Stichman, and this goes to Mr. Blocker's point about whether or not there's confusion among veterans in this case, but one of the veterans, the claim was denied, and the episode of care was in 2016. The claim was denied erroneously, but it was keyed in the database, because it's an insurance type database, as denied for coinsurance or deductible. The processing clerk corrected that 3 minutes later. The claim was paid as VA as the primary because the veteran's other health insurance didn't cover anything related to that claim. And keep in mind that the primary versus secondary insurance situation is something that's happening on a per claim basis. So VA paid as primary. The claim was paid in full in 2017. So now VHA is going through the list, the master list, which is a spreadsheet of 75,000 veterans that are in the class. And one of the three that's hired Mr. Stichman doesn't have any claims to re-adjudicate. The claim was paid in full in 2017. So there was no letter, and yet VHA correctly categorized this person on the 45-day status report as having all claims adjudicated.
And did VA provide the information that you just told us to counsel?
Well, Your Honor, Mr.
Well, you can explain, but the question I asked you was a yes or no. The information that you just provided to us, which I understood, I follow exactly. Somebody hit a button A on the computer that said denied, and they said, holy crap, it should have been button B that says granted. They did it, but you can never erase time. So for a nanosecond, that claim was denied, even if erroneously, and then it was corrected. Okay. And as a technical matter, VA casts a wide net to bring everybody into the class that could be captured by the definition, and that's a good thing. So in this one anomalous situation, and maybe there is a handful of others, there was an erroneous denial that's immediately corrected, right? Seems to me, well, somebody might say, oh, well, can you show us that? Leave that aside. Did you provide that information to Mr. Blocker or Mr. Stichman or one of their associates?
Your Honor, no, but that's because when I requested the VHA to, you know, look into these 41 letters, and in particular, the letters related to the three veterans that have hired Mr. Stichman, the one that we're speaking about, they produced a letter from 2017. And I questioned, well, wait a second, why do we have a letter from 2017 granting this claim when the class wasn't even certified until 2019? And the processing of claims didn't even begin until 2020 after judgment entered. So that opened up a discussion which led to the discovery of what exactly is the claim stream here and how is it possible for a claim to have been denied and then granted prior to class certification. And as it turns out, that the sort of explanation I provided to you is kind of how it happened. So now we're grappling, and many of the issues that class counsel has brought up with regard to the status reports, we've tried to remedy and address. And this is kind of one of them, which is, do we need to send veterans who have claims that were resolved prior to class certification because in this case there was a mistake and it was immediately corrected, or in other cases the provider, because again these are insurance claims, the provider resubmitted the claim, which happens often, with new information showing that VA could pay as primary and the claim was paid. Do we need to send those veterans now a letter saying you previously received correspondence indicating you're in the Wolf class, but we reviewed your claim and there's actually no claim to re-adjudicate, so
But why didn't you tell Mr. Blocker this? Why do we have to wait until we get to court and you have a perfectly legitimate or sound or believable or credible explanation? But why don't you give it to class counsel?
Well, Your Honor,
if you could sit here and now we've got judicial involvement, why couldn't you just give it to him?
Well, Your Honor, I found this out after the argument was already scheduled, but I think another question is, why does the veteran think that he needs Mr. Stichman's assistance to prosecute his claim when the claim doesn't exist? The claim was granted in 2017. And the reason the veteran is confused, perhaps, is because the system is really set up for providers, medical providers, to liaise with VA as the secondary payer. And the medical providers are the ones that are submitting the claims. So the veteran has received all of these letters essentially telling them you have a claim that was denied and that puts you in the class, which is true. And yet there's no claim to be paid.
All right. I've lost. Can you hear me?
I can.
I have lost my picture on my screen. For some reason, and if you can hear me, I can hear you. I'm going to ask that IT try to figure out what happened here, but why don't you proceed with your argument?
Okay. Everybody else can hear me. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
This might be a good chance for me to interject then while Judge Greenberg's getting his camera fixed. It seems, based on what you said here, that you're just looking for a court order from us. And if so, why don't you just sit down with Mr. Blocker and put together the court order that you'd like us to issue?
Well, Your Honor, it's a little more than that. We think that we need a court order in order to disclose the information and that we can't do what class counsel has asked, which is essentially just release veterans' private information without a court order. But we also think that the court shouldn't issue the order in this case because counsel hasn't shown that they have a need to have veterans' protected health information for purposes of fulfilling their role. Their role does not include seeing veterans' protected health information contained in VA decision letters.
Well, then the court order could say that the protected information is redacted from the adjudication letters or re-adjudication letters.
Well, Your Honor, the court order could say that. The letters themselves are protected essentially because they fall under the HIPAA privacy rule because they're coming from VHA. We would have to still, if we're talking about the 41 veterans, that's sort of one matter. But anything larger than that, well, actually, with regard to any letters and correspondence, VHA would always have to redact out 7332 information because that's protected information on an individual basis. But the process of reviewing all of these decision letters to redact out or make sure there's no 7332 data in them is going to be time consuming. And one of the things class counsel has complained about is the pace of the re-adjudications. And that process is certainly not going to speed things up. But one of the things that Mr. Blocker had mentioned is that based on class counsel's evaluation of the status reports, it's going to take 17 years to re-adjudicate the claims. In some of the pleadings that have been filed, the reference has been to 18 years. And it's just not accurate. There's 75,000 veterans in the class, and the number of claims associated with those veterans that were denied for coinsurance or deductibles is around 260,000 claims, right? Because there's multiple claims associated with each episode of care. And the project of re-adjudications, the re-adjudication project started in May of 2020. As of February 21st, 2021, which was the date that the last data was pulled to provide the February status report, VA had processed, either granted, denied, or requested an EOB for 117,494 claims. So they're not quite halfway through, but it was slower in the beginning. It's ramped up with training, and there may be, I guess, around 40% through the project. So it's not going to take 18 years.
Ms. Bernal, can I jump in here? I mean, part of the answer that you've just given to Judge Falvey, I appreciate, and is one of the reasons that the court is considering the option of appointing a special master, because it appears at times that, you know, one party is speaking French, the other one Italian. There's some overlap, but there are different languages. But in any event, let me just go back to the very beginning of what I understood Judge Falvey's question to be. There are 40 or 41 people, as I understand it now, that were what I'm going to call the random sample, okay? Where VA says there's been an adjudication or a notice sent, and the veteran seems to say, I didn't know about that. There can be lots of reasons why that happened, right? What would be the harm in us issuing an order that simply said, as to these 41 people, since VA classified them as having a decision or a notice, I'm not sure what word was used, but provide just for those 41, as redacted as required by HIPAA rules, the document that VA asserts is the notice that was sent. Because if at that point VA can't provide it, then we have an issue. If VA can provide it, then we have some piece of information that perhaps veterans' understanding is not reliable. But the burden associated with 41 documents, it strikes me, has got to be relatively small, because we're not talking about 75,000. We're not talking about everybody. And we're not having an ongoing process. We're saying this seems to show potential issues. Let's get to the ground whether there's any fire for what that might be, this smoke. So what would be the problem with that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if there would be a problem with it. It's more that it's an issue for the court to decide, to weigh the 41 veterans' privacy interests and determine whether class counsel has demonstrated that they have a compelling need for this information.
Why would it be compelling? I mean, I understand this is medical information. When I was in practice, I practiced at a big law firm, and we did a lot of class actions on the defense side, often with respect to financial institutions. And in situations in which a class was certified, class counsel got information, quite sensitive information, protected by federal laws, a lot more federal laws now than when I practiced. But this is part and parcel of the fact of appointing class counsel and the heightened fiduciary duties that they have. And so here, the situation is VA says that these adjudications happen. The veterans say they didn't. Right? How else would we be able to resolve whether or not the veterans saying it didn't happen raises a possibility that there's a problem? I mean, otherwise it seems to me we just would have to say, well, VA said they did it, and therefore the fact that the veteran said they didn't doesn't matter because VA said they did. There's got to be some way that can be done.
Right, Your Honor, this, as Mr. Blocker had mentioned, there's not much precedent here. But this kind of question about the release of information to class counsel usually comes up in the discovery stage of the class proceedings, where counsel is asking for some type of protected health information. And in those cases, federal courts seem to use Rule 26 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure as a guide, which I think uses the phrase good cause to release the information. But that is pre-certification. Here, class counsel has been appointed. So the court would be the decision maker in whether or not class counsel has shown they need this information to fulfill their role and monitor implementation of the class. And the secretary's position is essentially that despite the the problems that have been raised with the 45-day list, that essentially the 45-day lists are sufficient to demonstrate that re-adjudications are happening and advise counsel of the progress of the re-adjudications. And some of the things that counsel has identified on the list as inaccuracies are not actually inaccuracies. It's things that
Could I stop you for a second? There are all, I sat through the entire argument with you and Mr. Blocker before about the reports, right? I'm now just talking just these 41 people, okay? Are you maintaining to the court that you are confident, you representing the secretary, are confident that in every one of those cases, there has been a decision letter rendered or whatever the proper term is that for the classification, whether it was decision, adjudication, notice? I mean, did it happen?
Your Honor, it happened for most of them, and the others, it's because of the reason that I explained previously, where there's about, I think, five, maybe six, including the one that the veteran who's hired Mr. Stitchman, where the claims were paid before the class was certified because the provider had resubmitted. So VA didn't generate a letter for those. And we're now, because this issue has been brought to our attention by class counsel, kind of considering, do we need to issue a letter to those veterans and let them know that even though there were no claims to re-adjudicate, they received previous correspondence from VA telling them they were in the class. But upon review, their claim had been granted at some earlier date. So there's not, you know, it still remains granted.
But okay, so for that universe of five or six, which suggests perhaps that the pushing of the two different buttons is a bigger issue than it might appear, because we're talking about a universe of 40 or 41, and if five or six of them, that's a fairly big percentage, right? With respect to the others, let's say 35 of them, give or take, you know for certain that there has been a letter, and the veteran saying that it didn't happen, they're just wrong?
Your Honor, I do know for certain that there's been a letter, but the veteran, I don't know if the veteran had received it. The veteran likely hadn't received it yet at the time the call was made from class counsel, right? Because we're reporting the status and there may be some lag time between mailing and the actual status. Because the decision, the 45-day reports, you know, it's a work in progress. It's a living document. We're improving it as we go. But one of the things that we're trying to ensure consistency about is the claim reported as complete? Does that mean a decision letter has been sent? Or does that mean it's complete and a decision letter will be sent? And the report that the 41 veterans were identified on, the 41 veterans we're talking about, it was from October of 2020. So at that time, it seemed that a decision had been made, but it wasn't confirmed that a letter had gone out the door. We've since improved that process to make sure that if a veteran is listed as having all claims complete, or all claims, some action taken on their case, that also means that notice has been sent as well. They shouldn't be reported.
And I can understand that, right? The reports, as I've said in other contexts, the reports are means, not an end, right? The reports aren't the goal in and of themselves, right? Have you and Mr. Blocker, and when I use you and Mr. Blocker, I'm including all of the people who work with you, has the information that you've just provided here saying, wait, you know, there's an explanation why a veteran might say, I didn't get a decision, but it looked like we said you did get a decision. It's because if the decision was prepared, we've counted it, even if it hadn't yet gone out the door. Have you had that discussion before this morning?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Blocker and I are in actually relatively close contact regularly about this case and talk about the status of claims often. But what's happened is that when things are brought to my attention, it's kind of in concert with a court filing at the same time. So then I'm put in the position of responding in writing. And that kind of happened here with regard to this motion to clarify. They asked about the 41 veterans, and I reported back to them that only one of the veterans was misclassified on the report. And then they asked for the decision letters, and I said, well, we can't release those decision letters because of privacy rules. And here we are. So it's not for a lack of communication, but I think that there are some challenges with class counsel's understanding of the class, because again, they have said some things in their filings that don't seem to be consistent with the class of claims that they have and their understanding of the reports, one of which was in the Solzi notice, which is that the B and the D lists are mutually exclusive. A veteran couldn't appear on both lists, but that's not true. The only difference between the two lists are the date of the emergency care and the claims associated with the care. So if a veteran was hospitalized in 2016 and had claims denied, they're going to appear on the B as in boy list. If that same veteran went back to the hospital in 2019, they are also, and had claims denied, they're going to appear on the D as in dog list. And so it's the same person on both lists, and that's not a duplicate or a mistake. And yet class counsel will raise that kind of thing as a mistake to the court, and it's not, you know, but the issues that they have raised that are actually mistakes or errors, VA has been quick to remedy and will continue to be quick to remedy as we continue to go through this process.
All right, keep going.
Well, Your Honor.
Don't worry about the time. Take as much time as you need to complete your argument.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Again, the Secretary's position is that class counsel hasn't made the showing that release of veterans' private health information is necessary to monitor re-adjudications of class claims, and that if the court were to issue an order, it should be very narrowly tailored to provide only the information that counsel needs to fulfill their role, and that decision letters with protected health information or requests for explanation of benefits do not fall into the category of correspondence that's necessary to monitor compliance with the court's orders.
Well, what about just did you pay it or didn't you pay it? What's that got to do with HIPAA?
Well, Your Honor, as you know, for many of the claims where we have to request an explanation of benefits in order to determine what the other health insurance paid, so we can determine if there's a coinsurance or deductible that VA can pay. And so we're requesting those explanation of benefits from veterans, and they're not actually responding in a very high rate. So far, the average reimbursement's been $46.
Average of what?
The average amount paid to veterans for class re-adjudications has been $46.
Yeah, so, and how many of the 75,000 are in that category?
Well, it's 75,000 veterans and 117,000 claims. I think I don't know, Your Honor. I think I recall somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 have been paid. Based on those mostly because we had the explanation of benefits on file at the time the claim was re-adjudicated.
Has the STOB payment been made lately?
Your Honor, I would like to answer that question. Could you, just since we're talking about the HIPAA privacy rule here and I'm going to talk about his personal information, can you just clarify that you're ordering me to do that?
No, I'm asking you. I'm not ordering you to do anything. I'm not getting in a contest with you as to the meaning of HIPAA or what the secretary, I assume the secretary for the last 10 years has vaguely been trying to act in good faith with what Congress has mandated, what this court has mandated twice, once in 2016 and again in 2019. I'm not ordering you to do anything. Why can't you answer whether Mr. Staub's payment, as described in the Staub case, as portrayed as part of this class, has been paid?
Well, Your Honor, I can answer. I just was concerned about revealing his personal health information since we're streaming on YouTube.
I'm not asking you to reveal anything.
Well, Your Honor, it's part of the answer because of his insurance. But in any event, he has been paid. He has his claim, the bulk of the $48,000 that he originally asserted was related to his care is for private nursing home care. And some of it is actually related to legal fees for his attorneys in representing him. But he had three episodes of care, essentially, that pulled him into the class. And this is the part that I was concerned about discussing. But because he has Medicare Part A, that is the type of insurance that covers hospital facility charges only. So, and it uses a deductible. Your Honor, I see I'm out of
time. Just keep going. Add 10 more minutes. That's strictly arbitrary. Take as much time as you need to answer the court's questions and to complete your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the 2010, December 2010 episode of care that Mr. Staub had, because it was at the end of the year and Medicare uses a deductible system, he had already fulfilled his deductible by the time he was hospitalized in December of 2010. And so there was no coinsurance or deductible to pay. His Medicare paid the facility fee because they cover only the hospital. And then all the other charges related to the doctors are considered charges where VA is the primary payer because Medicare Part A doesn't cover doctors. So VA paid primary on all of Mr. Staub's other claims for 2010. In January 2011, as you know, he went back to the hospital. That's the beginning of the year. And so his deductible had not been met. Medicare Part A covered the facility again and left him with a deductible of $1,132.
I appreciate this.
Which has been paid.
Let me interrupt you. When was Staub paid whatever the secretary thinks he's entitled to be paid under the statute and the court's rulings? When was that payment completed?
Your Honor, was entitled to be paid a deductible. It was done as part of the re-adjudications and payment was processed on, I believe the claim was processed for payment on January 21st, 2021, or possibly January 28th, 2021. And that's because he's on the list of veterans who are getting their claims re-adjudicated. And when they got to his, he had a deductible associated with his 2011 episode of care, and he was re-adjudicated and paid.
And does class counsel know this?
Well,
what you've told them?
Your Honor, I'm not. I believe Mr. Staub was reflected on the last status report as being paid. And if he wasn't, he'll be captured on the next status report as being paid because his claims have been adjudicated now.
All right. Thank you. Continue with your argument.
Your Honor, in summary, the secretary's position is that the 45-day status reports are sufficient to apprise class counsel as to the status of the re-adjudications and that class counsel hasn't shown that they need access to veterans' personal protected health information to fulfill that role. And because of that, the court should not grant an order. And if the court is inclined to grant an order, it should be limited to the 41 veterans referenced in counsel's motion and require counsel to show a need in any future instances prior to any additional disclosures.
Thank you. Do either of my colleagues have any questions for counsel at this point? Don't go away, Ms. Bernal. We may come back to you after we've heard from appellant's counsel. Go ahead, Judge Allen.
I don't have any questions, Judge Greenberg.
Judge Falvey?
I've got a few. You know, it strikes me that Mr. Blocker seems like a reasonable fellow. You seem quite reasonable. You've revealed a lot of information to the court today that you may or may not have revealed to Mr. Blocker before today. You all got to do a better job of communicating with each other because you have three federal judges sitting here arbitrating a dispute that in many ways seems very factual. Should the veterans who were received letters, the three veterans or four veterans who received letters saying they were going to be re-adjudicated, and then you learned that they aren't going to be re-adjudicated, I'm stunned that they aren't getting another letter, or they haven't gotten an already letter. Get them another letter so that they realize they're not members of the Wolf class, so that they aren't obtaining representation from Mr. Stichman or anyone else. Judge Allen asked Mr. Blocker a question about the line to draw between class representation and individual representation. Mr. Blocker said it should be a broad definition, a broad test. He said in many ways you got to trust the reasonableness of class counsel. Where would you put that line?
Your Honor, I think that it goes back to the court weighing the veterans' individual privacy interests versus the need for class counsel to have access to the information. Here, it's a little bit of a unique situation because the Veterans Health Administration is involved and it's protected health data. Usually, in most of the cases that we see before this court, it involves information from the Veterans Benefit Administration, and that wouldn't necessarily invoke the HIPAA automatically. But I think that the line is if counsel shows good cause or good cause for their need for the information. And here we don't think they've made that showing. And of course, you know, the court may disagree, but there has to be some test that recognizes the veterans in rights to their privacy and their own information. Because keep in mind, as you noted, none of these veterans have the ability to opt out. And they've been assigned, class counsel has been appointed to represent this group of 75,000 people that, you know, none of these veterans know, you know, personally hired any of these attorneys. So for the court, we've released names and addresses, and, you know, that's one thing, but if further releases are involved, it's going to potentially include veteran social security numbers, veteran personal health information, veteran claim data that these individual veterans have not consented to release.
And that's why communication between you and class counsel is so important, because you know what these documents contain. We may or may not. And if what you're looking for is a court order, you could have crafted the court order that protects all those interests and said, this is something that we as the secretary can live with, rather than relying on us to do something that might, in our ignorance, go too far. Which brings me to my last question. Mr. Blocker talks about, you know, the class counsel's role in monitoring compliance with the court's order. But Judge Greenberg talked in terms of our role in supervising the VA, and by implication, Mr. Blocker's role in supervising the VA. What's your response to that? That categorization of the class or our role as a court in ensuring compliance with our orders?
Well, Your Honor, the court has a role in monitoring, in ensuring that its orders are enforced. In the April 6, 2020 order that the court issued, which sort of paved the way to the judgment, you said directly that you didn't have a role in supervising the class post-judgment because that wouldn't be an appropriate role given that judgment was going to enter and the secretary had indicated that he planned to appeal, which he did. So at this point, the court's role, I think, is to ensure that its order is being enforced, and the court does have a role in making sure that's happening. And again, the secretary is re-adjudicating the claims. There's no dispute that the claims are being re-adjudicated or that the 45-day status reports are being produced. It's more of a dispute about pace and accuracy as opposed to compliance. As far as class counsel's role, I don't think it's to supervise VA's implementation. It's to monitor, and this is something that the court had said also in its April 6, 2020 order, that class counsel has a role in monitoring that implementation of the court's orders to ensure that VA is complying. But the secretary believes that that monitoring is done by having counsel become aware that a decision has been made on each individual veteran's claim, not necessarily seeing the contents of the decision itself, that their role doesn't allow them to review the decision letter itself because it contains protected health information. Their monitoring would not go beyond knowing that the decision or confirming that the decision had been rendered. If that answers your question.
Thank you. That's all I have. Thanks.
Mr. Greenberg, if I could just ask one thing.
Sure.
That's actually two points. First, I want to reiterate what Judge Falvey said. It's not just to VA, it's to everybody involved in this. The communication efforts, through no fault of any one person, have not been stellar in this. And I urged you all before, and it didn't seem to work, but I'm urging you again. This is why I hope that the parties would be able to agree about a special master to help them, but that didn't happen. So I urge that. But on a broader point, I understand what you're saying, Ms. Bernal, about class actions. Class actions are an odd world. I don't know if you've had experience in them. They're just an odd form of litigation. For better or worse, the Federal Circuit has said to us, we have class action authority. Maybe the Federal Circuit was entirely wrong, but they said it and we've adopted it. And there are going to be class actions. And I just hope this is not for you, because you're the face now, and it's not even for Ms. Moriarty probably. But the VA should start to think about the fact that constant fighting as if a class action were not going to be the thing that the agency has to deal with in the long run will not be productive for the agency, because it is the world in which we now live, through nobody's fault on this call, right? And so maybe the Federal Circuit sorts some things out down the road, but you know, until then, we really, to reiterate, we should not have been here to convene to talk about a way to confirm the 41 people. The party should have been able to deal with that. And so hopefully going forward, that will be better. And so I just wanted to reiterate that for the parties, because this has been sort of a harbinger of things to come that doesn't look very good, I think.
All right. Anything else, Ms. Bernal?
No, thank you, Your Honor. That's all for me.
So we'll turn to Mr. Blocker.
Your Honors, I want to address a couple of the things you talked about with Ms. Bernal, but I want to start with the points that I think all three judges have made about improving the communication. And trust me, on the petitioner side, message received. We will make every effort to improve communication with the VA, but I feel slightly compelled to defend ourselves here, because we did the history here on the 41 is we did send an email saying we would like the 41 decisions and we would like to have the address to which EOBs should be sent by class members, because they received letters that didn't have an address to which EOBs should be sent. The response we got from the secretary was that they were not going to provide any of that information. The next thing that we did was to ask for a meet and confer. We specifically asked for a meet and confer before bringing this motion, and our request for a meet and confer was turned down.
Let me just...
I agree with...
Just a minute, Mr. Blocker. How is this working? Is Ms. Bernal the person you deal with on all matters, these sort of administrative matters. She seems to know quite a bit about the details of each adjudication and the class and so forth. I think I've got confidence in her knowledge, but is she the one who's answering these questions that U.S. class counsel have, or are you dealing with the a different group entirely? Well, how is it working?
The interface, Judge Greenberg, between the two sides is generally between Ms. Bernal and myself. So when Ms. Bernal says we speak frequently, she's speaking the truth. We speak frequently. I don't have visibility into when Ms. Bernal says we're not willing to engage and meet and confer if she's communicating a message or making that decision on her own. She'd have to answer that for you. But I just wanted to make clear to the court, I understand your frustration. It's frustrating for us to have to bring a motion asking for what we view as basic information. But again, we did ask for a meet and confer. I think in the last few motions that we've brought, we've always preceded it with a request for a meet and confer. And I think we also told Ms. Bernal we were planning to seek the appointment of a special master before we did it. I'm not 100% positive on that. But admonition taken, we will try and improve communication. But to the questions Judge Falvey asked about, we shouldn't have to hear a dispute that sounds fact-based. I agree with you, Judge Falvey. I couldn't agree more. But that's separately why we've asked for appointment of a special master. We can't keep coming to this court. I don't think it's an efficient use of this court's resources for us to bring issues like this to you. I think this panel is going to issue an order that will look a lot like what a special master would have put in place. The special master, he or she, would have said, that seems like a reasonable request. And by the way, Judge Allen, all the information I'm hearing today about the 41, about, or the three, it's information I'm hearing for the first time. If we had had the meet and confer, if the secretary had taken us up on that, maybe we wouldn't have filed this motion. I don't know. Maybe we would have run into some problem down the line. But we're doing what we can to try and foster communication. We're not here to just transiently pound on the table and say it's got to be our way. We're always willing to negotiate. We just want to get the information. And the other thing I think that Ms. Bernal said, which I think sort of inadvertently undermines the whole notion that we shouldn't get this sort of information, is she's telling you flat out these status reports have been inaccurate. And she said, I think, quote, we're improving as we go. They are improving as they go. They're improving because we are pointing out errors. Would the VA find those errors without class counsel looking at this and trying to adjudicate or try and evaluate what we're getting and looking at it and asking for information to verify? And again, if she would have just said, well, here, I've got all the decisions, but I can't give them to you. Or if she would have just given us the decisions, again, maybe we wouldn't be here. But she's explained to you exactly why class counsel should have a role. We are, by their own admission, improving this process. And at the end of the day, while we are on the opposite sides of the V for purposes of today and for this litigation, we have the same interests. We have the same interests as VA. We want to get all these claims re-adjudicated and veterans paid as rapidly as possible. Putting to one side whatever's going to happen.
Blocker, just to follow on something Judge Falvey asked at the end of Ms. Bernal's argument, you would agree with the basic principle of constitutional/administrative law, right? That neither the role of the court nor the role of a special master nor the role of class counsel would be to actually supervise or take over VA's processes, right? And so the question is, if something falls on the side of the line of ensuring compliance with the judicial order, then that's consistent with separation of powers and administrative law principles. But simply going in and taking over an entity, that's generally not, unless we reach the point of intransigence like the prison litigation systems in some respects. You'd agree with that fundamental principle that I understood to be at the heart of what Judge Falvey's question was, right?
I agree with that fundamental principle. And to expand on my answer, Judge, Ms. Bernal's drawing a distinction, I think, here between assisting in enforcement and monitoring and supervising. We aren't here to supervise. We don't have the ability to supervise. All we really can do is monitor the compliance with this court's order, and that's what I understand our role to be. We're not in there trying to take over what VA is doing or telling them how to do it, but we should be given information. If we have concerns about how it's being done, we should be able to air those concerns somewhere. And, you know, the special master, in our view, you know, you've heard a lot about that, but would be, I think, an ideal vehicle for that, because that's somebody who could convene more frequently and without having to convene and take up the time of three distinguished judges in order to resolve something. I think that would help cut through some of that. But no, we're not seeking to supervise, and nowhere in our papers do we suggest that. All we're asking is for, you know, we get 45-day reports. That's our sole tool right now to monitor compliance, but we ask for follow-ups. And, you know, if VA could meet us even halfway, we'd be better off. But, you know, what we're asking for here isn't a gargantuan ask. But I do want to address Ms. Bernal's point also about where to draw the line. She wants to have a good cause standard. First of all, if what you're looking for is an interpretation of 23F5, which is what we've been talking about, I don't think that's the appropriate standard. A good cause standard isn't appropriate, because what's in the rule right now is it says related to the class proceedings. But more importantly, I'm not aware of any court that imposes a, quote, good faith or good cause standard on class counsel needing information to represent the class and to enforce a judgment. I'm not aware of that, of any court embracing that sort of a standard, and it doesn't make sense to do here. As I said, I think the rule and the standard should be interpreted broadly so that you err on the side of giving class counsel information to, be able to monitor what the VA is doing, and not to supervise. And that, you know, as long as the request is reasonable, that line ought to be drawn in a very class-friendly fashion. I understand where Ms. Bernal is coming from. You know, the secretary doesn't want us involved at all. But unfortunately, to your point, Judge Allen, we are involved. We've now been appointed the representative of a class, and that has legal significance, and that makes a difference. And I do think that our motion as a result should be granted. One last point I wanted to make about the, the privacy protections and the HIPAA statute. The HIPAA statute was so important I just look back, it was not even cited in the secretary's response to our motion. But put that to one side, this isn't the first time the secretary has been asked to provide decisions. We pointed that out in our original motion. In the Niemer case, the secretary agreed to provide information about re-adjudications, and since 2010 has provided over 100,000 either re-adjudications or letters. So, and I'm not aware that privacy concerns were raised in that case. So the secretary can do it if it wants to do it. It just doesn't want to do it. But I think this court could give guidance in ruling on our motion and hopefully in granting our motion that, you know, you said, Judge Allen, like, this doesn't portend well for the future. And I agree with you. Continuing to have these sort of disputes without guidance from the court doesn't portend well. But the court could issue an order here that I think would go a long way towards helping the parties understand what their respective roles are so that class counsel can carry out its obligations. So unless there are any other questions the panel has, I'm concluded.
Judge Falvey, any further questions?
No, I would like to, I'm sure you will, thank both counsel for their very thorough arguments, and at least nothing that I said should be seen as diminishing my respect. And
move your microphone to your...
Sorry about that. Anyways, I think counsel had done a great job arguing, and I appreciate their efforts. One of the things I miss about doing these in person is coming down and actually thanking you for your arguments. You guys did a great job, and we really appreciate it.
Judge Allen?
I don't have questions, but I concur with Judge Falvey. The one thing that I'm 100% sure about that this case has demonstrated is this is a lot of difficult issues that we're all facing, and I want to thank counsel for their effort.
And I, as well, I was very impressed with both counsel in terms of your written submissions and the good faith effort that you're bringing to bear on this. Nobody should be surprised by class actions. They've been around, I think, as I pointed out, since Edward II in England, one way or another. So we're all, I think, attempting to get to the same place, as pointed out perhaps by both of you, to ensure that the statute is complied with. But we've been at this for a long time. The statute was adopted in December 2009, early 2010. Here we are in 2021. And so let me encourage, on behalf of my colleagues and the court, that you continue your efforts, and you'll hear from us soon. The case is submitted. Thanks again.
Thank you. The court is in recess.